It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's vegetarian mystery meats, also known as the rookie vegan saviors. I'm talking about things like seitan, tempeh, and the oh-so-tempting-sounding textured soy protein. Our guest is Crescent Dragon Wagon. She is author of Passionate Vegetarian. Well, the Sterns are in Rome, as in Italy, and what have they turned up? The Bakery of Burnt Food. Wine Whiz Joshua Wesson brings us the newest darling, Southern Italian wines. Then Washington Post Bureau Chief T.R. Reid takes us out to eat in Nepal, and Team Maven Bill Waddington has bargains in great tea. But the key is knowing the flush. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you. unisci come un miraggio, amore che viene che vai, come una cosa leggera. Non andare via.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today, we slip the veil away from what I call vegetarian mystery meats. I'm talking foods that could be straight meat substitutes, foods like seitan and tempeh. Well, our guest is expert chef and longtime vegan Crescent Dragon Wagon, author of Passionate Vegetarian. Wine Whiz Joshua Wesson brings us the newest darlings of the wine world, the wines of southern Italy. Then it's the strange food scene in Nepal with journalist T.R. Reid. Our T-man, Bill Waddington, explains the flush. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern have stepped into the studio, so let's roll. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we have been eating in the ghetto and having a wonderful time doing it.
In the ghetto?
Which ghetto?
The ghetto of Rome.
Oh, no. Don't tell me. You mean you two finally got to Italy? I can't believe this.
We did indeed. We were sent there by our editors at Gourmet, who seem to think it's very amusing to send the Sterns, who spend our time wandering around the Appalachians or Texas or Montana, to Europe and see what we experienced there. And sure enough, we went to Rome and had a fabulous time and ate very, very well.
We were helped by our friend Mimi Murphy, who in fact, since the name Murphy doesn't translate in Italian, calls herself Mimi Mercury in Rome, and she speaks fluent Italian, and she's a great source of where to eat. So she took us to the Jewish ghetto, and she introduced us to one of our favorite places, which I can't pronounce, but what Michael and I call it is the burnt bakery.
Well, I think it's something like Pasticceria Il Boccione, and the reason we call it the burnt bakery is that virtually everything they make there is slightly burnt in the best possible way.
What do you mean by burnt?
Okay, you go in to this little bakery, and there's always just lines of people flowing out the door, and people are lining up to get, let's say, the ricotta cheesecake. And you know how the top of a cheesecake will be browned?
Right.
These are black.
These are somewhere between brown and black, and sort of the top is burnt, so it kind of splits open a little bit. There's a fissure in it, and the honey almond cookies are a little bit too well done, and the creme brulee is a little too well done. But somehow it's the best. I mean, it's...
Well, that scorched flavor really adds something to the creaminess of the cheesecake.
Yeah, it caramelizes everything. It's just wonderful.
Sounds good to me. What else did you find in the ghetto?
We found wonderful kosher pizza, meaning pizza that is made without any dairy product whatsoever. It's only topped with lots of different vegetables, colorful as can be. You get your pizza at Zifinizia is the name of the place, a kosher pizzeria topped with grape tomatoes, artichoke leaves, zucchini shreds, onion slices, endives, broccoletti florets. It's wonderful. All the vegetables are just delicious, you know, with olive oil and salt. What's really good, though, of course, is the pizza itself, that wonderful thin, airy flatbread that defines Roman pizza.
You know, I noticed in the Jewish ghetto, that was one of the few areas that we saw when we were in Rome where people really get the food to go and eat it on the street. You know, it's sort of, you know, off a piece of wax paper.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem that I had was that it's all cobblestones. There is an ancient, you know, old part of the city. And so Michael kept going in and getting me slices of pizza, which, you know, I would instantly drop on the cobblestones because I would lurch forward. So I think we went through about five different slices before I actually got one in my mouth, but it was delicious.
Did you eat in any restaurants? I'm wondering, did you ever actually sit down and have a meal?
We did indeed. Just down the street, Via del Portico d'Ottavia, we found Taverna del Ghetto, which looks from the outside like a simple storefront. Inside, there's a maitre d' in a tuxedo. You get seated at a table, and you eat what the menu promises is Roman Jewish food. And that includes everything from an item listed as Grandma Esther's meatballs, which were great, big, wonderful meatballs, to a unique dish that I think some other restaurants there serve that was really just fabulous, called fried artichoke Jewish style.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about
here.
Oh,
you got to describe this one.
Well, it's like a huge bouquet of deep-fried artichokes so that the leaves become like parchment crisp.
They're almost like potato chips.
Well, and they're as addictive as potato chips. I mean, I cannot stop eating one of these things. They're just, because they still have that artichoke flavor and a little bit of the meat of the artichoke, but the outside is real crusty and crisp and salty. Oh, it's so good.
That may be the greatest classic dish to come out of that area. And it's so good.
Well, I still will take the burnt bakery and then run back to our hotel where we slept in frette sheets, hand ironed, changed twice a day.
Yeah, we were roughing it.
Yeah. Michael could not drag me out of bed except to go to the burnt bakery twice a day.
Hey, guys, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
A tindes a mano que han furado a babudo, pronto la hora de canto de empujo mandada.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book in their road food series is Louie's Backyard Cookbook. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their road food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert with a democratic streak a mile wide. He believes wine and snobism do not mix, and he's always looking for exceptional bottles for little money. Josh stops by regularly to answer our questions and to share his finds. Hey, Josh, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
I always like to know what you've been tasting and what you've been up to.
Well, I it's cold here in New York, and when it's cold, I think of warm places. And the warm place that I've been thinking of lately is southern Italy, because it's so off the radar screen for a lot of people who love wine. And I have taken it to be my task, my mission, to put it on the radar screen, because the wines there are just yummy, very delicious.
There are also some good buys down there, aren't there?
Well, you know, it's the source of, I think, some of the greatest wine values on the planet. And it's a place that was really the center of Roman winemaking. It's where, when the Romans and the Greeks were in charge of things, most of the world's wine came from. And it fell into disrepair and obscurity in the 17th and 18th centuries, and it's really come back in the last 15 years, and especially in the last 5 years. There's been a tsunami of delicious wine coming from places like Calabria and Basilicata and Molise, and of course people know about Sicily and Apulia, but the last tasting that I went to of southern Italian wines focused on these lost regions, these places that even Italian wine folks generally don't venture to or know a great deal about. And consequently, the wines are really inexpensive because there's no demand for them, and they just blew my mind.
Well, can you give us some names?
Well, Calabria is this place. It's a very poor part of Italy. It's so poor, in fact, they have no food down there.
Oh, I no beg cuisine. To differ. Wonderful food in Calabria. But it's the toe of the boot, and it's not an easy place for folks to live, I think. You know, I mean,
yeah, it's not an easy place for folks to live. It's a great place to sort of connect to Sicily if you're driving down there. It's probably the only place that you could get that close to the island. But you're in the toe of the boot. You're going to be looking at vineyards all around you. And the top dog in Calabria is a wine called Ciro. And it's spelled very simply, C-I-R-O. And it's a wonderful red wine. There are a number of very good producers there. My favorite, and the one that's easiest to find, is called Librandi. And the Chiro is just, it's so sunny and so warm and so inviting that you really would have to be, a red wine Scrooge not to like this wine.
Well, now, you mentioned Basilicata, which is the arch of the boot. What would you recommend from there?
Basilicata is most well known as a wine region for the wines that are grown on the slopes of this once live and now dead volcano called Monte Volturi, Vulture Mountain. And the wines that come from there are made from a grape called Aglianico, which is an Italian corruption of Hellenico. And you can imagine that these grapes actually came over from Greece. And indeed, the Aglianico vine is one of the oldest vines to be continued as a cultivar in the world. Hmm. And the Aglianico del Volturi, the Aglianico grown on the slopes of Vulture Mountain, is just delicious. The wines are a little bit richer and a little bit fuller than the Chiro that comes from Calabria. They're a little bit more serious, and they usually get a little bit more time in the barrel, too. So they take on some of the toastiness and smokiness that red wines that sit in the barrel take on. But I love them for what they're not, and they're not Merlot, they're not Sangiovese, they're not Nebbiolo, they're not Cabernet. They have a flavor that's so distinctive, it's so old world, you can't get any more old world than this.
What about price?
Well, these wines are a little bit more expensive because they get a little bit more kid glove treatment than the wines down in Calabria do. And whereas a Chiro might cost you about $10, a really good wine, and one of my favorites, the D'Angelo Aglianico del Volturi, would sell for around $12 to $15, depending upon the year.
Okay.
But that's not a lot of money to get all that class and style in a bottle.
Well, it sounds pretty reasonable. What about Molese? That region, which is, the lost region. Nobody ever goes there. Central
Nobody
Italy.
Nobody goes
Little,
there.
Yeah.
It's one of the smallest wine regions in Italy. And even though Italy's covered in vines, it has, I think, the second lowest or the lowest production in terms of wine output of any province in Italy. Still, there are wines there that are really delicious. And there's a very modern, outrageously good for the money producer named DiMaggio Narante. Leonardo Locascio, who is one of the most respected importers of Italian wine in the United States, brought this wine in. And you can get a Sangiovese from DiMaggio Narante for $8 or $9. $10 is probably the full tilt list price, but you can find it discounted. And you stick it in a bag and you give it at a party to a bunch of knowing wine palates, and they will all say that it's a $20 Sangiovese or more. It tastes that good. It's phenomenal wine.
Hey, Josh, thanks.
Yeah, a pleasure.
Wine expert Joshua Wesson is creator of Best Sellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find his wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. And every week, there's a new recipe for quick worknight suppers, tips on techniques, and what to check out in the market. And the best part? It's free. All you have to do is register. Just go to splendidtable.org. Coming up, the mystery meats of vegetarians, dining out in Nepal, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, Super Target features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the Super Target nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. So you're cutting back on meat and wondering what to eat instead. There's rice and beans, there's vegetables, but what about the direct approach? A straight meat substitute. Seitan, tofu, tempeh. Am I scaring you? Well, I have somebody who can change that. She's an exceptional cook, a chef, and a longtime vegetarian. Crescent Dragon Wagon. Her book is Passionate Vegetarian. Crescent, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
But what I'd like to concentrate on is something that I call vegetarian mystery meats. And I mean, these are the things that you think of as, for those of us who aren't vegetarians, they're the straight substitutes for meat. But a lot of people are hesitant to try them. So for everybody who's holding out there, I need a little primer. For instance, tofu.
Well, now, first of all, I would go on to say that they're not meat equivalents or substitutes. They're like a parallel universe. And although these foods might seem very new to us, in the case of tofu, that's a food that has been eaten for thousands and thousands of years in Asia. And now I know a lot of people assume tofu, you know, make the sign of the cross as if you're seeing a vampire or something. but actually, as you learn more about it, it reveals its mysteries of how to prepare it. Now, tofu is no more one substance than a cow is one cut of beef.
But from what I understand, isn't there, there's silken, there's firm, there are different categories of tofu.
Sure, and they each have their own cooking qualities. So whereas that silken tofu would be good in a dessert or a dip, mm-hmm. it would be very mediocre stir-fried. For that, you would want a conventional water-packed tofu. There are also lots of tofus these days that are marinated and baked that you can slice and put in a sandwich that are perhaps spiced or garliced or done with lemon and herbs.
All right, what about seitan?
Seitan is not a soy food. It's not derived from soy as is tofu and tempeh, which we haven't visited yet. Seitan, again, it's an ancient food from Asia, mostly used. And this one is a little bit weird. If you imagine taking flour, those who are bakers listening know that the protein content of flour is a substance called gluten.
Mm-hmm.
And the starch and fiber components of the flour are rinsed off, and you end up with this weird little spongy ball of gluten, which is then processed by being simmered in usually a flavored broth, and it ends up very brown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's high in protein. It's not a whole food because obviously some portions of the wheat have been rinsed away.
Right.
But it is high in protein. And although you could certainly never dress it up as a T-bone steak, in anything like a goulash, a stew, a pot roast kind of a recipe, anything mm-hmm. that is where it's napped in a savory broth or sauce, it is a dead ringer. And my story on that is there's a stew that's called Deep December Stew of Seitan and shiitake mushrooms. And I brought that to a potluck in my little town. You know, it's 2,000 people. It's in the Ozarks. And I figure, you know, that's really, if it plays there. So I brought this, and my banker came up to me and she said, "Oh, Crescent, that stew is incredible. But tell me, what is your secret? How did you get your beef so tender?"
So essentially, the seitan, you could say that if you've got a favorite beef recipe, a stew-like recipe, this may be something to try.
Absolutely.
What about tempeh?
Tempeh, again, we're back to the soybean products. And whereas with tofu, it's made from a process by which soy milk is made and then the milk is curdled, as in making cheese. Tempeh is made with the whole beans, and the whole beans are partially cooked, and the beans are split in half. And as cheese is given a you know, inoculated with a particular bacteria to get blue cheese or cheddar cheese. There is a fungus by design. It just sounds horrible, I know, but think about how almost anything is made. It's inoculated with a beneficial bacteria, and these cakes of fermented soybeans become tempeh. And to me, it almost is a little bit vealish in some of its incarnations. You can also buy, and this is a great introduction for a lot of people, you can buy strips of smoked tempeh that you sauté as a breakfast side protein dish, as you would use bacon. Now, is it crisp and fatty and roughly like bacon? No. But it gives you, it's again, it's its own thing.
Crescent, what in heaven's name is textured soy protein?
Isn't that the most horrible name? It is the protein component of soybeans, very high in protein, that is dehydrated and is sort of a kibbled looking thing. And it's a buff color. And, you know, it's not my favorite ones, but just the other day I was making some chili and I was going to add some what's called ready ground tofu, which is dark and looks sort of ground beefy. Mm-hmm. And I remembered that I had some TVP on the shelf, and I thought, you pour a little boiling water and some marinated spices over it and rehydrate it and stir it in with, in the case of chili, your sauteed onions, peppers, spices. And it takes on the flavors of what's around it, but it does give you a very ground beefy texture, and it adds a great deal of protein to the food. And by the time you have your chili finished, if you hadn't made it yourself and you were a vegetarian, you would be saying to the waitress, are you sure this doesn't have ground beef in it?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a useful food. It's light, it keeps forever, high protein, inexpensive, and terrible marketing problem.
Yes, exactly. Hey, Crescent, thank you.
You are so welcome.
Crescent Dragonwagon is author of Passionate Vegetarian, a collection of a mere 1,000 recipes. Find her recipe for deep December ragu of seitan, shiitakes, and winter vegetables on the website, splendidtable.org. Some people get the best jobs. The last time we talked with editor and writer T.R. Reid, he was in London with the Washington Post and telling us about the food scene there. Now T.R. Reid has just come back from a month-long stint researching a story for National Geographic. Wait until you hear where he's been. T.R. Reid, welcome back.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
Okay, so what was the deal with the National Geographic?
In May of 2003 is the 50th anniversary of the first descent of Mount Everest, and National Geographic owns this story. Nobody is going to cover that 50th anniversary better than National Geographic, and they sent me to Nepal to write about the Sherpas. When you do something for National Geographic, they really do it right. So I actually spent about 2 months in Nepal researching this story.
So now, you know, we're very interested in all this business about Everest, but what we really want to know is, what did you eat?
Yeah. Mostly in Nepal, you eat dal bhat. You know what dal bhat is?
No. What is it?
This is rice with a kind of a thick lentil soup thrown on top of it. It's kind of reminiscent of what the Japanese call karairaisu, curry rice.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a thick white rice with this lentil soup on top of it. Dal bhat, dal bhat, dal bhat. That's what you eat. I came to think of it as dal butt because you have it all the time. But it's actually, like other Nepali food, it's plain, it's simple, and when it's done right, it's really quite delicious.
But I understand that Kathmandu, now isn't that the capital of the country?
Yes, that's the capital of Nepal.
Yeah, I understand that there has been an awful lot happening there over the past couple of decades, that it's changed a great deal.
Well, it's still an incredibly poor country. I mean, a guy will take you in a rickshaw for the entire day, and if you pay him $2, he just about falls at your feet. He's so amazed to get that fee. Very poor country, sad in many ways. But yeah, there's a lot of, the whole tourist industry is centered in Kathmandu, and so there are a lot of restaurants. There are a lot of good places to eat. When I'm in a place, I tend to stick to the local food, so I ate a lot of dal bhat, I ate a lot of Nepali food, but you can get anything there.
What else is there about Nepali food, though, that's kind of intriguing?
It's cheap. It's amazing. That whole country is cheap. One day in late September, I went out to a place for breakfast. It just amazed me so much. I wrote in my diary what I had for breakfast. Here's what I had: two eggs, sausage, ham, toast, fried potatoes, a tea, orange juice, and then they put a whole banana down there, and this cost me 60 rupees. You know how much that is?
No, how much is it?
72 cents.
Oh, my goodness.
For that breakfast. It's just amazing. The one acquired taste that I never quite acquired in Nepal is something called Sherpa tea. Have you ever heard of this?
I've heard of it, but I'm not sure what it is.
It's an unusual concoction. They actually make this tea in a butter churn kind of. They make it in a wooden barrel kind of thing, and they pump it up with this churner. They put in this yak butter. They put a lot of salt in it and some other flavorings. It's a very astringent, it's almost vinegary, bitter tea. They drink it like we drink Coca-Cola. I just could never get into Sherpa tea myself.
You know, you mentioned something that got me curious about that breakfast. This is a Hindu country. This is a country that doesn't eat meat. So where are we? Ham? Bacon? Sausage?
Yeah, that's made. It is a Hindu country. It's very hard to get cattle kind of beef. But you can get steak, and the standard sizzling steak there is yak steak, which I found marvelous. You've had venison or elk, a kind of gamier meat than beef. It's just slightly gamier. I just thought yak was marvelous. It's incredibly lean, just makes great steak, and yak sausage is to die for. It's awesome.
So, T.R., what's the Western influence in food there with all the tourism?
You know, in the 1960s, a bunch of American hippies went to Nepal because you could get free drugs, I think, and it was a cheap place to live. And one of the guys who went there was a fellow from Nebraska named Mike, and he started a restaurant called Mike's Breakfast, and Mike's Breakfast is still going. And it is the place to see every Westerner in Nepal, from the U.S. ambassador on down. Everybody's there. Mike's Breakfast serves not only breakfast, but also lunch and dinner. And they're doing kind of, what would you call it, fusion nowadays? I mean, they do have dal bhat, you know, dal bhat, but they also make these marvelous trout sandwiches. It's just it's very well done. I don't know where Mike gets his ingredients, but there's good food, both Nepali and Western there. But the really interesting thing about Nepali Western food is that country has the world's best cinnamon bun.
The best what?
Cinnamon bun. This is in a town at about 15,000 feet, Namche Bazaar. And the only way to get there is to fly to Lukla, and then you walk straight up on a dusty mountain trail for 6 hours to get to Namche. And when you get there, you go into Hermann Helmer's German Konditorei, and he's got a wood stove. Yes, in Namche Bazaar, Nepal, he's got a wood stove, and he makes these German cinnamon buns. It's a pretty good cinnamon bun, but you had to earn it. You had to walk 6 hours straight up a mountain to get there, and that makes it the best cinnamon bun you ever had.
T.R. Reid, thank you.
Sure.
T.R. Reid is the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Merchant Bill Waddington has been researching teas, going to their sources, and constantly learning for over 20 years. He owns the tea source in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he stops by often. Hey, Bill, it's good to have you back in the studio.
It's great to be back here, Lynn.
Bill, I keep coming across this term. What in heaven's name is a flush?
When they're talking about tea and flushes, you'll often hear the term first flush, second flush, autumnal flush. First flush simply refers to the time of the year of the picking of the leaf. So the first flush is the first picking of the year. Usually occurs for Indian teas March through May. Second flush is the second picking of the year, June, July-ish. Mm-hmm. Autumnal flush refers to the last picking of the year.
Now, does this mean that it's going to new plants and they're picking new plants, or is it pinching back the way I do with my basil plant?
The second one of those. It's just like pinching back your basil plants.
So it keeps sprouting up new leaves, and then you pick those top leaves.
And you only pick the top two leaves in the bud, so then there's a little period of dormancy as those top two leaves in a bud regrow.
So you've got an entire tea plant with all those leaves, and you're just using the top two leaves?
That's the only leaves that go into good quality tea. Absolutely.
Can you taste a difference from one flush to the next?
Why don't you tell me in a minute? Because right now I'm steeping up a tea from the Pudabong Estate in Darjeeling. And the only difference between these two teas is they were picked about 8 weeks apart.
So one is a first flush.
Exactly.
And one is a second flush.
Exactly.
Are first flushes usually more expensive?
First flushes are sometimes dramatically more expensive, ridiculously more expensive. I love first flushes, so it's almost a hardship for me, but people get crazy about the first spring tea of the year sometimes.
Well, it's like the first pea of the year.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And there's actually insane bidding sometimes that goes on between Germany, Japan, and the Saudi Arabian Peninsula for the very first flushes of the year.
Now, can I get some bargains if I'm willing to drink second and third flushes?
Absolutely. There are a lot of people who think second flush is a better tea. It's certainly a more complex flavor. In Darjeeling's, it has a little bit less astringency, but it has more body, and it definitely has more complexity to it, more layers of flavor in the second flush. The autumnal flush, third flush of the year, typically will get a little bit mellower, a little bit smoother, less astringency still.
Oh, so if I like mellow and smooth teas, I can walk into a tea shop and say, excuse me, but could I have a third flush?
Third flush, autumnal
flush. I will
flush.
Feel so powerful if I can do that.
And they will look at you with awe.
Good. This is very good. Okay, you're pouring out two different cups of tea. Now, this is the same tea, but one's a first and one's a second?
Exact same tea from the exact same estate, the Pudabong Estate, plucked by the same pickers. The only difference is one was made about 8 weeks later than the other.
All right. I'm looking at one cup that has a pale golden yellow color, and then the other one is more brown, deeper, richer color.
And that'll transcend to the flavor, I hope.
Okay. So the paler one's the first.
That's the first flush.
This is the first flush. The aroma is nice and robust. Oh, that's really nice. Astringency, a hint of, I can't explain it, but it tastes green.
And that's actually,
it's not a green tea, but it tastes
first
green.
First flushes will have a very fresh flavor to them, much more so.
It's a light tea.
Exactly.
Okay, now to the second flush. This is the deeper color. Oh, now the aroma is more, you know what it reminds me of? I know this is not that it's woody, but it reminds me of the richness of a fire.
That's a good description.
This is bigger. It's sort of round in your mouth. And you don't taste the astringency as much because you just got more body to the tea.
Exactly.
And it has a fullness to it. I think I'm definitely a second flush girl.
And that means you're a bargain, too.
Okay. I've always tried to be a cheap date. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Lynn. It was fun.
You can find tea merchant Bill Waddington at the Tea Source in St. Paul, Minnesota, but you can find his tea picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. This question was inspired by a caller, and here it is. Why do chefs wear black and white check pants and those tall hats? Well, we're going to have those answers in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Super Target, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes, from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, this one was inspired by a caller's question. The question was, why do chefs wear black and white checked pants and those tall hats? Well, we went to Chef Jean-Georges Van Gerichten's website and found out all kinds of information. Now, the checked pants are designed to hide stains. The tall cylindrical chef's hat started out as camouflage. At least, that's Jean-Georges's story. Now, apparently in the 1500s, free-thinking artisans, like chefs, were often persecuted. So some chefs took refuge in the Orthodox Church, hiding among the priests. For disguise, they adopted the priest's tall hats. Well, the tallest hat in today's kitchen tells you who the head chef is. And by the way, the classic hats, they're called toques, always have 101 pleats. Why? To show off the fact that a top chef can cook an egg 101 ways. The lines are officially open. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We got Jocelyn on the line. Hey, Jocelyn, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm having a little problem because I'm trying to make one of those clever little cages out of spun sugar. You know how you drizzle the spun sugar one way, and then you go at 90 degrees to that to make this clever little cage that you put over a dessert.
You are an ambitious woman.
I am.
Maybe you have too much time on your hands, but go ahead, go ahead.
No, I just love decorating things nicely. And my problem was I tried making the caramel the same way as you make the creme caramel, the bottom of the creme caramel.
Right.
Which is just taking the sugar and letting it melt. I know that's not the right word, but, you know, letting it go liquid.
Right.
And what happened was when I tried making them, they looked really pretty.
Right.
And I took them off the little bowl that I made them on, and they looked wonderful, but they kept on breaking. And so I went to, opposite your favorite shop in Ann Arbor, Zingerman's, there is a wonderful kitchen supply place called Kitchenport.
Mm-hmm.
And I had every person in there scouring the cookbooks to try and find out what I was doing wrong or if I should add some water to that sugar.
No. Well, no, you could add water to the sugar, but that's not going to change what's happening.
Oh.
First of all, to fill in everybody who's listening so they can picture this, this is one of the most elegant ways you could serve. And, I mean, you could take a Hostess cupcake and put a caramel cage over it. And don't you agree? I mean, Joss, it would look dynamite. This is where you make sugar syrup. You essentially melt sugar, and you could use a little water to help the process until it's the color of a caramel. And then you dip. Do you use a fork, or what do you use to actually get the long strength?
Actually, maybe this is my problem. I just drizzled it direct from the saucepan, just very carefully.
Ah, okay. I think we can solve this problem a little bit.
Okay.
The idea is you either take a fork, or there's actually something that has a lot of tines on it that's a special instrument. You spread a lot of newspaper on the floor. You take whatever size you want your cage to be. You find that size bowl, and you oil the outside of the bowl. Mm-hmm. And you set this in the midst of newspaper, you know, so because you're talking now about having flying caramel going around in your kitchen. Yeah. And get the dogs, the cats, and the kids out of the way. They don't come into the room. And the idea is that you want to drizzle fine threads, crisscrossing them, over the back of this oiled bowl. And when that hardens, you can remove the bowl, and by gum, you've got this fragile little cage of caramel that you can put over your desserts.
Well, and it's the fragility that is the problem.
Right.
Because I made 5 of them, and 3 of them crumbled.
Oh, golly. Oh, Lord. I wonder, because normally you do it with very fine threads that you just keep crisscrossing.
Mm.
You know, the motion is like painting a wall with a roller. You know, you keep doing odd crisscrosses, and you keep, the more you sort of fling this in the air over the bowl, you know, the finer the threads get. You can get very theatrical with it. It's great. I mean, it really is wonderful fun. Just wear gloves, because that's hot sugar, and you know, wear an apron, and you know, do this in shorts and flip-flops. But I think one of the things is, you rather than pouring from the bowl, use either a fork, a teaspoon, and build the cage so that it's a lot of very fine crisscross threads.
I think I was doing it too thick.
Maybe so.
So that there were only a few crisscrosses.
Oh, no. You want a whole very fine mesh.
Oh.
Now, that doesn't mean it's going to last forever, because this is really fragile.
Mm.
One of the tricks that's used in the pastry business is that they leave it on the form and they remove it from the form. So in so many words, if you want to do 5 of them, you got to have 5 little forms for them.
Oh, yes, I was doing that, yes.
Okay.
In fact, I was using the bottom of the ramekins that I used to make my custard.
Well, that's great.
Yes.
That's great. I'd say leave them there, but do a lot of fine threads and think a fineness of crisscross between chicken wire and the screen you have on your screen door.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome. Goodbye.
Bye.
I guarantee you do these wonderful caramel cages, people will, they'll kiss the hem of your slacks. I mean, as you come into the dining room, everybody just plotzes when they see this kind of thing. 800-537-5252. We have Judy on the line. So, Judy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, listen, I have some halibut that I caught last summer in Alaska, and I've got it freeze. You know, I've seal-a-mealed it, and but I'm tired of tempura battering it, which is, I think, the best way to have halibut cheeks and things.
Right.
And I remember reading a recipe one time. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but it had a wasabi. I think it had a layer of wasabi on top, and it was almost, I think it was a sesame seed crust.
Huh. It sounds...
That sounds familiar.
It sounds vaguely familiar. I'm still sitting thinking about what it was like to be up in Alaska catching your own fish. This sounds
but
so
everybody
great.
Does that. It's no big deal. It's halibut fishing is fishing for dummies.
Oh, so. I see. Well, I'm impressed.
Thanks.
Really impressed. Yes, wasabi coated fish I've run across, but here's the thing. You gotta mute that wasabi, because have you ever worked with it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a green horseradish powder that's that when you have sushi and that kind of thing, it's that little dot of stuff that can clear your sinuses in about 4 seconds.
Right.
So when you use it, it makes a lot of sense to dilute it a bit and either do that with something like sake, which would be kind of interesting, or a little bit of soy sauce.
Hmm.
Because if you think about it, a lot of people, when they dip their sushi,
right,
they dip it into soy sauce after they've taken a little wasabi.
Right.
So if you rub that along with a little sesame oil or actual sesame seeds over the fish,
yeah,
that makes sense. And then you could try grilling it.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't sound excited, though, Judy.
No,
this doesn't, we're not reaching
reason,
you.
Here's what I wanted. I wanted that pretty white fish with that just a slight layer of green, and then I thought maybe toasting, like, say, some black on one side and white sesame on the other side.
Ooh.
I just thought it would look interesting.
I think it does look interesting. but maybe. No, I love the idea. It's just that it's the green of the wasabi. If we have that much wasabi,
oh, I know.
You're going to run out of the room
about
screaming.
That, but I wasn't sure how to temper it.
But, yeah, you want to temper
it. Are you saying when I make my wasabi paste, use soy as opposed to...
No, make the make wasabi paste with water.
Okay.
The way you normally would.
Yeah.
The other thing you could do is use a little vinegar or a little sake. Now, neither one of those have color.
Yeah.
And I would trust your taste buds. No, you want a little bit of punch from the wasabi, but you don't want it to be killing you.
Yeah.
So I would try that and then do the white sesame and the dark sesame, which are the Japanese sesame seeds, which are really beautiful. The other thing you could do, you know, is puree up some basil. I mean, this is going in a completely different direction. Puree up a little bit of basil with olive oil.
Okay.
Grill the fish and then roll it in basil, olive oil with a little garlic. Don't cook it at all. Don't cook that mixture. And then do the black sesame and the white sesame and see what you get.
Oh, that might be great. I think I'll try that as opposed to wasabi. You're right. That might be too intense.
And boy, will it be good.
Okay, great.
Hey, enjoy.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
So that's Fishing for Dummies. I have to remember this. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. And we have got Rick calling. Rick, what is up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, first, I have to tell you how much I enjoy your show. I think it's just great.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. We have a good time, I must say.
And I spent a couple of years in the military in Alaska. And if you want Fishing for Dummies, it has to be fishing for salmon, doing the salmon run. You don't even need to use bait. You just take a treble hook, cast it out, and reel it in, and you snag fish as they go by.
Oh, my. Oh, gosh. Okay, I'm going to stop dreaming. Do you have a question now?
Yes,
that I'm
do.
Lusting I'm, after I, the salmon at this point?
I'm looking for a recipe for corn soup. I'm trying to replicate a soup, a wonderful corn soup that I had once in New Orleans. It was corn soup with guacamole and lump meat crab.
Oh, brother. Was it in the summer?
Yes, it was in the summer. Yeah. It was during the New Orleans Jazz Festival.
Boy, does that sound good. Okay, couple of thoughts on corn soup. One of the greatest corn soups I've ever had was with corn cobs, making a broth from the cob. In so many words, you got the fresh corn. Now, this means you're going to have to wait until summer or get really good corn that's coming in from Florida or wherever.
Okay.
But because, you know, now these sweet enhanced varieties often are hold up well enough that they can be shipped. Anyway, the idea is you would take, you'd find great flavored corn, you know, taste it before you buy it kind
right.
of thing. You'd cut the corn away from the cob and you take the cob, and my mouth is watering at the thought of this. You take a little bit of onion and you'd saute it in a small amount of butter in a saucepan.
Right.
You'd cut up the cobs, add them, add water, even a tiny bit of chicken broth, and you'd simmer that for 20 minutes or so.
Okay.
Because what you're making is a corn broth. And then you'd puree half the corn you got off the cob, and you'd leave the rest whole, and you'd add a little bit of cream to that broth, and you would stir in the corn. And you'd cook it just, I mean, long enough, I mean, a matter of a minute or two, because okay. you want all that bright corn taste. And then what you could do is drop the crab meat, just let the heat of the that broth, you know, warm up that crab meat, because the crab meat's going to be in small pieces anyway, you see.
Uh-huh.
And it could even go in before the corn. And then how was the guacamole figured? Was it actually floated in the soup?
Well, what he did was he kind of mixed the guacamole and the crab meat together in like a maybe a half cup container, and then put it right in the middle of the corn soup.
Okay, so you lightly cook your crab meat.
Right.
Yeah, and then you chill it, and you get mix it up with the guacamole. Oh, I get it. Now, did the soup have an acid tang to it as well?
I can't remember that. I don't think it did.
Because my great delight in something like this is that you have a little pinch of chili in the broth and you have just a hint of lime that you sprinkle over the crab and guacamole as you're serving it.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So the idea is it's a little onion and butter. You soften it because that gives a sweet backdrop. You add water and maybe a little broth, but you add the corn cobs. You let it cook 20, 30 minutes. You strain it. And then you put in a ton of this corn, half of which has been pureed. So it's like cream corn. And you can add a little cream.
Thank you.
It may not be the same soup, but it won't be bad.
I think it's going to be better. It sounds great.
And now we're really hungry. Hey, hey, Rick, thanks for the kind words.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Goodbye. Well, evidently, hunkering down for an evening of mindless diversion with a TV movie is becoming the pastime of the privileged, as well as the rest of us. The lavish Peninsula Beverly Hills Hotel is now sending up TV dinners to their rooms. We have the Peninsula's executive chef on the line, Bill Bracken. Hey, Bill, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Bill, why don't you explain what you're doing?
TV dinners on room service menu. It was a kind of a funny idea that we came together with, and it's been a big hit. And really, we're doing TV dinners in the Peninsula five-star, five-diamond manner.
So what inspired this? Were people just not eating in the restaurants anymore?
No, I, to be honest with you, what inspired it was when I saw this porcelain TV tray at a local gourmet restaurant homeware store that I just loved, and I bought it and brought it back to the hotel and said, what am I going to do with this?
So now you're talking about essentially like a china plate that has sections in it, just the way the TV aluminum tray for the TV dinner
just does? Like Swanson's used to be, yeah, but obviously porcelain, nicely made.
So what are your TV dinners like?
Right now, we just started with four of them, to be honest with you, and I wanted to go very traditional, very classic, as much as possible to the old ones that you used to buy in the stores, but obviously made fresh and everything.
Right.
They sold so well that we're going to expand on it and make them a little bit more modern. But the first ones I introduced was a classic meatloaf. On the menu, it reads Grandma Bracken's all beef meatloaf with mashed potatoes and mushroom gravy. We have a chicken fried steak, beef stroganoff, and then a fish potato crusted chili and sea bass. And they're, again, a typical TV dinner in the presentation of them or the thought process of them. I put peas and carrots in all of them because that's obviously a classic in a TV dinner.
Right.
But they're fresh English peas and baby carrots, so it's not the squared carrots and the frozen peas that you'd get at the grocery store.
Well, heck, you're at the Peninsula.
Of course. And then each of them comes with the dessert. Right now we're doing an apple cobbler, but that varies often. We, you know, sometimes we'll put a warm berry crisp in there, sometimes some sort of a warm chocolate cake. We even go so far as to serve it on a TV tray. We bought nice wooden TV trays to serve it on. We obviously don't throw everything in there and heat it up in the oven. It's all made a la minute and put into the trays. We then cover the tray with aluminum foil when we're done so that it even looks like that thing you used to buy in the freezer section.
Well, the other thing that occurs to me, I mean, I'm thinking TV viewing. Can I get microwave popcorn from room service?
Absolutely microwave, but even better yet, we make fresh popped with truffle oil, which is a nice added touch.
I love it. Hey, Bill, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, it's healthier than butter. Bill Bracken is executive chef at the Peninsula Beverly Hills Hotel. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Joan London. She said, show me a person who doesn't like French fries and we'll swap lies. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website. That's splendidtable.org. And be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. All the proceeds go to support this very program. Oh, and by the way, don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Hey, thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.